Welcome, adventurer, to the Level Up Board Game Podcast, a show that uses your experiences and opinions to discuss board games and the gaming community. Join the heroes as they conquer perils such as meeples, cards, and miniatures, all in an effort to level up. You're listening to the Level Up Board Game Podcast.
Okay, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
I like you. I really do. I like you. But we've been so busy with things lately. My wife thinks that you're taking away her time with me. So I'm sure that whenever you contacted me, you want to do a side quest, it's got to be something important.
It is important. In fact, it is a currently live Kickstarter that doesn't have a whole lot of time to go. I think by the time that this airs, there's going to be about 2 weeks for listeners to check it out.
What are we looking at for our side quest tonight?
We're looking at a game by a designer named Shelby Matusik. He designed a game called Lonely Undead. Now, I know what you're thinking. Zombie theme. Right, Scott? You want to play some more zombies, right?
Hey. We live in the Pittsburgh area. Zombies are part of our makeup here.
Oh, I guess they
are. You got me going yet.
You know what's funny? They have that school in Manesson. The factory. They do like film school. It's one of the film schools in our area, and it's actually one of the only ones aside from Point Park. And George Romero used to visit there before he passed.
And
he's
Tom
at all the
Savini.
Cons around here, right? And it's Tom Savini's school. He used to go in there regularly.
And actually, the funny thing with that is he comes and visits the Renaissance Festival every year because one of his close friends works at a booth there. His friend and his brother was the person that Tom Savini killed more than any other person on sets.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He was the one that whenever he killed Kevin Bacon in Friday the 13th and ran the arrow up through his throat, well, the hose popped off, so Tasso Stavrakis was down there thinking, okay, and just blew through it and made the blood go gushing through his throat.
We are a family show. Nah, my point being, you know, my first thought whenever I saw Lonely Undead was, do we really need another zombie-themed game? How many times can I be picking up shotguns or shooting bows and arrows at zombies and, you know, trying to be the last one standing? This takes a little bit of a different angle. Lonely Undead. So you play the role of the zombie and you're all alone. You want to make more friends. How does a zombie make friends?
By saying hello?
By biting people.
That was my second guess. That was my second guess. Honestly, I have it written down right here. By biting them. It was my second guess. Honestly.
No, right. So Shelby took that idea and made a zombie game of a different variety. And I had the chance to talk to him. We're going to kick into an interview with Shelby after the 8-Bit Breakdown. You ready for a little walkthrough, Scott?
Hey, I'm all set here. Win me over. Sell me on this game.
Designed by Shelby Matusik and currently live on Kickstarter, Lonely Undead is a game for 1-4 players who will take on the role of lonely zombies, wandering a town of the living trying to make new friends the only way they know how, by biting them and turning them into zombies, of course. The first player to make 7 friends will win the game. At the start of each game, each player is going to receive a zombie, or Z card as the game calls them. Now each Z has their own stats as well as an asymmetric ability. On this card, you'll find 4 limbs, which essentially represent your life, or, unlife? Let's just say hit points. If you ever lose all 4 of your limbs, you're eliminated from the game. The board is placed on the table, and the players are placed in the very center. The board contains several buildings, a roadway going through the middle from north to south as well as east to west, and it's seated with living tokens, representing the townfolk that you intend to charm. Now, these are face down, so you don't necessarily know which living you're going to encounter. This is important because the living not only have slightly varying powers, but also they have bonuses depending on where they're located. Lonely Undead is broken into 2 phases, the Z phase and the Town Reaction phase. On a player's turn, they can carry out 4 actions. Now, there's a lot to choose from. The first 3 are quite simple. Move, draw a card, or equip a card. But you also want to make friends. And how do you do that? Well, one of the actions, whenever you come close to a living token, is to do a stealth check. You're going to draw a card that represents that token. This essentially is a die roll to determine whether or not you've snuck up on that character. You may opt to attack the living, which again requires a die roll, which can injure them. Or finally, once injured, you can attempt to bite the living to convert them into a friend. Now, this also requires a die roll, but I should point out here that the game has several ways, primarily through 8 cards, to modify your roles. Once a player completes all of their actions, play passes to the next player, and when all players have completed their turns, the town phase begins. First off, players are going to draw a reaction card. Sometimes these are one-time effects or events, but other times they might modify the game moving forward, such as introducing a zombie-chasing dog to the board or moving a car down the road that intersects the game board. As you might expect, the driver of the car is terrified and doesn't stop for anything, mowing down dogs, living, and players as they pass by. Some of these cards are going to have perpetual effects that will occur with each town phase. This is where you'll carry out those recurring effects. Play continues until either 1Z has made 7 friends, or until there is only 1Z remaining on the board. So let's rejoin Scott and give the 8-bit breakdown to Lonely Undead.
My interest is piqued here. I'm not sure if I've actually played a game where I'm a zombie. Now, art and components.
Okay, let's start talking art and components. Now, mind you, listeners, we had the prototype copy. Kudos to Shelby. You could tell that there was a mountain of effort put into making this prototype. The game has a ton of bits. The art is playful, and it's all done by Shelby. If you check it out on Kickstarter right now, you'll be able to see what I'm talking about as far as how many bits there are, how much art there is. You can see it for yourself. There's a ton. There are a ton of chits. There's all these little town people. Every one of them has the image. You have your player card. It's got your characters on it as well. And Shelby did it all. I mean, kudos. I don't have the patience. I don't know how he did it. Well, listen about how he did it when we interview him. The components are primarily cards and standees. He's not a miniature guy. He said, you know what, the cost for diving into miniatures is just way up there. And standees in this case, for him, he said, it makes sense. What I really liked about this board, Scott, you can turn it over. It's like a city board. Okay, you're playing the game on a city board, and there's this alignment of buildings that make up the city. So the church is here, and then over there's the office building and a couple of residential houses, and you're wandering around through this town. If you flip the board over, the game also comes with little modular buildings. So the pieces, like where you find a person, it's going to interact with that building. If I find the preacher and he's in the church, or if I find a cop and he's in the police station, that's going to buff the stats of that human. It's going to make him a little bit harder to make him my friend. What's cool is you can take a static board and change that up by flipping it over and taking these modular tiles. And you know what? The police station is not going to be up here. We're going to put it right next to the mayor's mansion and right next to the church.
So you're saying you play on the one side board just how it is. You flip it over.
Yeah, it's preset.
So you've got like Castles of Mad King Ludwig where you're building your own city all over the place and making it up as you want.
Not as the game goes, though. You set it up prior to the game begins, but it's not a static setup. If I want the police station on the left this time, and then next game I want it next to the mayor's mansion up in that top right corner, you can do that. The only thing that doesn't change is that the park area is on the outer edges of the map, and there's a car that will drive across the middle, left and right, up and down. That's still going to work that way, but you can switch around where you want the buildings using these modular tiles. There was some thought put into the components of the game, and I appreciated that.
That's cool, giving you both options, being able to play the basic board right out of the game and then giving the variability, but we won't go into that because I'm sure that's going to come up in another bit here, a little bit further down the road. So we got the idea of the art and components all done by Shelby, which is very, very impressive. I mean, that's...
Before we move on, Scott, in the components, your life is... You have basically 4 hit points, and you have limbs to show your life points. Like this could have been a little like glass bead that slides over like a slider, 1, 2, 3, and 4. No, you get 4 little limb tokens, and they're shaped like limbs. One of them is an arm with a thumbs up, and one of them is a leg with a boot on it, and one of them's a gnawed hand. I thought that was clever, too.
That goes above and beyond what's expected, so that's very cool. Bit number 2, the theme.
Well, the theme, like we said, it's that you're a zombie, and you're trying to convert humans and make them into your friends. You're lonely, and that's the goal. Make friends. So this... That alone, right then and there, sort of injects a little bit of a lighter feel than a zombie game. You know, most zombie games is like, there's blood and gore, and you gotta take out you know, massive amounts of bodies in front of you and, you know, meet the objective, get the crossbow or whatever they have you doing in Zombie Side and countless others trying to survive like in Dead of Winter. In this one, no, you're trying to make friends. And, you know, the art being a little bit playful sort of pulls you into a lighter side, a lighter game than you might expect. What really got me going, this game has dogs that'll chase you. Kind of like an NPC, like a non-player character. You can have dogs that are roaming the board, and they'll start attacking you, and like you'll move away, and the dog will start chasing you. And I can like picture a movie, like a black and white movie. There's a zombie lumbering along, and this dog's chasing him, trying to get the bone hanging out of his leg. And to put you into the town, there's a car that can move left and right and up and down on the grid that is the board. And the car, things are going to trigger the car and make the car move. I played this in twice in one game, got hit by the car. The people can get hit by it, but the zombies can get hit by it too. And that makes it feel like it's an active town. You know, it's not just like a static setup. There's things happening. There's activity in this world that we're playing in it. The theme is clever. And behind it, there's a fun little game.
Okay, very cool. If you're doing the other side of the board and you're making your own town, it seems like there's a bit of complexity in that. And that will lead into our third bit. The complexity of the game. Is it easier than it sounds?
I would say it's as easy as it sounds. This is something that you could break out with a 10 or 12 year old, and they're going to have some fun with it. They're going to understand what they're doing, and they're going to play strategically. They're not going to have rules that go over their head. They're not going to have like a shifting economy that they can't quite wrap their brain around. They're going to get it. It's basically action allocation. The people that you're going to run into in this town, they have a stat that's going to show the number that you need to roll in order to injure them. And then once a zombie's injured, you attempt to bite them and convert them into a zombie. It's pretty easy to pick up. The easy factor here is that there isn't a litany of other things that you can do, like I said, messing with an economy, picking up and delivering, or scoring a variety of hidden objectives. It's actually quite simple. Your goal is use your actions, allocate them appropriately every turn until somebody has met the objective of how many friends they've made.
Okay. Sounds pretty straightforward.
It is.
Now, does the rule book make everything as simple as you're making it sound, as clear as it sounds?
For me, yes. I know you didn't get a chance to play this one with me, and I know that you didn't see the rule book. Obviously, it was a prototype rule book, which oftentimes what that means is, you know what's funny is before we started doing this, I thought prototype rule book, and I pictured like a stapled together, like Microsoft Word document. And it's not like that at all. What I mean whenever I say it's a prototype rule book is the author of the rulebook is actively talking to you. If you open up a rulebook for a board game, it's going to say, first players will do this, then players will do that. This one said, okay, here's the deal. This is a prototype. If you have questions, message me here. First thing you're going to do is this. This is why I did that. Like, it breaks the fourth wall. And sometimes I think for some people that can make it more difficult. For me, that actually makes it a lot easier. So I was able to sit through and read it in about 15 minutes. For me, it's set up the game and then flip through the book and see like, okay, if I move this here, what happens? Okay, and then I move that over there. And I just try and like play sample turns according to the rule book. And then as something comes, oh, wait a minute, I think I want to attack this guy. I can flip to that page and refresh my memory. And it was all there. There is a rule book right now up on the Kickstarter, so you can go check it out. And I've seen it a couple. It's very similar to the prototype book, only it doesn't have that fourth wall breaking as much. And it's laid out just as well.
Cool. Very good. Now, what is the learning curve? What's that for the average player that's going to come in and play the game? Is it a tough one to pick up, or is it very easy that one turn through, you're going to be dead on, ready to go?
For me, it was much the latter. But for me, it was I'm reading the rule book, and the learning curve for myself is interacting with the rule book and trying to figure out to the extent that I could teach it to my group. So for me, it's like, okay, can I master this to the extent that I can answer questions on the fly? I can say I didn't run into much gray area. And whenever I was teaching this, things were pretty straightforward. There aren't fiddly rules or exceptions that are going to come up. Once we were playing, once my group understood like, okay, these actions per turn, here's what you're trying to do. There wasn't a whole lot of like, okay, wait a minute. We have some gray area here. We have a variable that we hadn't considered. No, that doesn't come up. It's a pretty straightforward game. I think most groups, even younger players, within a turn or two, and I say that a lot whenever we review games, because I think that's pretty profound. I think that that gives a lot of gamers an idea of how complex a game might be or how difficult it is to learn. If I can say within a turn or a round of playing the game, you're going to have basically everything you need to know to play the remainder of the game. Yeah, this fits that bill.
Okay. What's it feel like for the replayability and variability of playing this game? Is there a lot of things to unlock in this? Is it going to change drastically over plays?
Well, it's definitely got the variability. First of all, you have a player character. I was Brittany. I was this little girl that she had an axe in her head. I was like, oh, yeah, the art's playful. When I was talking to Shelby, he's like, I was actually going to remove that one because I wasn't sure about the axe. I was like, no, I'm glad you kept it. I was playing a little girl with an axe in her head. Next game I could play is Billy. Like, you have multiple different characters that you can play. The living that you run into, they're represented by tokens with basically the same back. And whenever you run into a living, how do I know that it's a dad in that house? Well, I don't know. I have to go check out the house. I flip over the token. Oh, that dad's in there. And dad has his own stats. If it was mom would have her own stats. If it's a child, yes, you can. I don't want to say you can kill children. You can bite them and make them your friend, which sounds much nicer. If it's a child, they're easier to get. If it's a cop or if it's a firefighter or, you know, weightlifter, it's going to be harder to get that character. So where you discover things, that's going to be one of the variables that you run into. We had mentioned the board has the option of being customized. Holy variability. Now, I will say there's not going to be a whole world of difference based on, well, the police station's up here or the school's down there this time, because what's going to matter is what's in it. But you could theoretically lump a lot of things into one side of the board and lump only a few things in say the bottom left to try and make there be this competition in the top right to get conversions. There are various item cards and a whole bunch of them. Included with them, there's a bunch of action cards. You're not going to run through that deck in one play. There's competitive mode. There's solo mode. There's co-op mode. So three different ways to play. We've seen that with a few games lately. And to me, you know, if I'm buying a game because I have a competitive group, I might not care about the solo mode, so I don't care. I might not care about the solo or the co-op mode. So I might say, well, that doesn't matter to me. But for the people that do, that might want to try a game competitively, that might want to give it a try co-op, that then might want to give it a try solo. Oh, that's right there. Play it twice each time. You're going to have at least six plays out of it. And if you're one of those folks that you play a game 10, 15 times in each mode because you want to master it, you could play this game for months.
Well, that's always a good thing to hear there, because I like to have the variability. I like being able to go back and have a different puzzle each time. And that was something that I failed to ask earlier on, but you answered very well there as far as, is this more of a competitive game or cooperative game? As you said, it covers everything.
Well, you know what? I'm going to interrupt you real quick. You did mention, yeah, and I forgot to address it. You mentioned at the start of replayability, you know, some games, they have a higher cost and you want to know that you can continue to revisit them to get your money's worth. This game's on Kickstarter for $55, Scott. The amount of bits, the amount of standees, the amount of cards, all those variables that I just said, there are games that are $75, $80 that have half of that.
Right, right. Unfortunately, out of 8 bits, we got to come up to
this one.
Yep. With every game, there come shortfalls. They may be big ones. They may be little ones. It all depends. I think it's
If something is a bit, if something is a big shortfall, does that make it a big fall or a long fall? It's late.
You interrupted my train of thought for that.
Sorry. Yes.
I mean, it could be a big fall or a shortfall. Oh, God, you got me saying it now. But anyway.
We got to stop doing this in the evening, man.
I think this really has a lot to do with what people come into it expecting out of it. But were there any shortfalls?
The dreaded bit number 7. Shortfalls or downs. Okay. For me, this might be a tad simple. It's essentially a race to make friends. Now, that's going to be an upside for a lot of gaming groups. The groups that I play with, we tend to like a really meaty game. We couldn't put Brass away. This is not Brass. This is simple. that makes it approachable. And I think for a lot of people, that's an upside. For me, when I was saying like, oh, there aren't a whole lot of nuanced rules and issues that you can run into because you're not going to have these secret objectives or pick up and deliver, I personally wouldn't mind. You know, maybe Shelby wanted to leave some room for potential expansions. I wouldn't mind if there was some more things to keep track of, to take mental note of while you're playing. It felt like a step back from the level of game that I typically want to indulge in. This is an Ameritrash game, which, you know, I'm okay with that. We have the Shogun Showdown every year. This is an Ameritrash game. You might totally outplay someone and lose because you didn't roll well at the right time. Scott, you injure someone and then you bite them to convert them. So I'm playing this game with Brennan and I injure a guy and I didn't get to convert him. Brennan's following me around. So I injure him. I try and bite, didn't get him. Brennan's turn. He bit him, got him. It's Brennan's friend. So I did the dirty work. He came in, you know what I mean? Like I made the spaghetti. He came in and ate the plate. And then he did it again. And I'm telling you, I would have won that game if it didn't happen. You got to be okay with that. And that makes for a good story. That's fun. It's funny. You know, we had some some tension going, some stand up and laugh out loud. But there are times where I want to sit down and I want to outplay someone. And I want to really use my brain power. And if I lose, it's because they outplayed me. Wow, that's profound. This isn't going to give you that. It's going to give you some fun, swingy plays. And you know what? Last note, there's definitely a part of me that wants miniatures for the characters.
Oh,
there's
sure,
a little
girl
with the axe in the head. I thought, oh man, that would really suck me in a little bit more. That said, as with any downsides, these are things that I identify. And I see, you know what? That's a downside for me. And some of them, like the fact that the game is simpler than I might have preferred, well, that's going to be an upside for a lot of groups.
Okay. As you said, that with being an upside for a lot of groups leads into bit number 8. Was it fun? And who's this for?
Oh, it was fun. I'd play this again if I was given the opportunity, but I don't know if this is going to get to the table over other games that have more meat on the bones. No pun intended.
God.
If I wanted a similar experience, being, we'll say, a more experienced gamer or someone that wants a little bit of a heavier game, I might opt for a pick up and deliver game that has a few more bells and whistles. This felt like it wanted to be a sandbox, or maybe I programmed it in my mind is I want this to be a sandbox game. Azaya, Wasteland Express, something like that. And it's not. So maybe that's on me. That said, I still had a lot of fun with this. I don't know if it's going to make it to the table when I have my game groups over, if I have my nephews over, if I have some folks that don't do a lot of gaming and I want to say, hey, you guys want to try something kind of ridiculous? You're going to play as a zombie. You're going to try and make friends. What? Wait, really? This is one that I could break out, whereas something like Wasteland Express, I'd be like, okay, here's how the adjusting economy works. They're going to shut down in no time. So this is something that can cater to them. So I'm kind of dabbling into who's it for. Okay, I said this is an Ameritrash game. You can play it with your family. There is tension and there's moments where you're going to find yourself standing around the table and you know you need that critical role and it needs to work. This has that. And it can reward careful planning on your turns, but it does still have that luck involved where no matter how much you carefully plan, things can go awry. I think it's a great game to introduce to a group of varying skill levels. If you have someone who's new to games and they're coming over to your group of folks that play every other weekend, well, you guys know what you're looking for. You have a general idea of which actions are going to be more valuable, even if you've never played the game. This newbie doesn't necessarily. This person you're trying to introduce and you know, get them to embrace your group, they don't necessarily know that. Whenever you introduce an element of randomness, that sometimes will even the playing field. And I think this does that. It's not a terribly lengthy game either. If you want a game that's going to build up some tension and get some laughs, I think Lonely Undead is going to fit the bill for you.
Well, that's our 8-bit breakdown of Lonely Undead. It does sound like a fun game. I know I've fallen into the thing with a lot of zombie games, and a lot of them get to the point where you're just like sludging through it and everything. I know the game Zombies gets like that a little bit, and you're just doing the same thing over and over. But doing this and having different people that you're trying to find and make them your friends.
I wish you had a chance to play this one with me.
I'm hoping that in future I get a chance to give it a try. That sounds very, very cool. I'm interested in hearing what Shelby has to say about the game that he created. So let's hear Shelby and Patrick talk about Lonely Undead.
Scott, I told you I could get him. I'm sitting here today with Shelby Matusik, the designer of current Kickstarter game, Lonely Undead. How you doing today, Shelby?
I'm great. Thanks for asking, man.
Well, we always like to start the course of these conversations with, what is your gaming background? Where did it all begin?
I feel like I don't have some of the typical sort of gaming background. But then again, I don't know what the typical gaming background even is. But it's nice to kind of hear all the different stories for how people got started. My childhood, I definitely always, my parents didn't want us in front of like the TV a lot or in front of video games. And so they were constantly, you know, pushing, you know, myself as well as I had an older brother and our siblings to get out and get outside or to
get
try
outside.
To, you know, get outside. Definitely. So I spent a lot of time outside, which you're outside as a sibling, you know, with your siblings and you engage in games, you know, maybe not board games, but in games in general. And I think games are extremely important to people's lives, not just board games, but all sorts of games. But I think that's kind of where it started. And then, of course, I started playing, you know, some board games with my siblings. And ironically, as even though this is like a heavy hitter, you don't really hear this sort of like a entry level game. But one of the games I recall playing the most as a kid with my older brother was actually chess. I do remember this game called Trouble. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, with the Pop-O-Matic bubble.
Yeah, you pop a little bubble. I do remember playing plenty of Trouble when I was a kid and then like Skip-Bo and Uno and stuff like that. But I think chess really like sort of really set me on the pathway for like being what some people would call like sort of a more involved or a heavier gamer. Just those people that really like latch a hold of the strategy and the thoughts, the cognitive like sort of firings that happen with games rather than just like a surface level sort of play or a party sort of feeling of a playing of a game. And so, I mean, my older brother, he always just annihilated me in chess, but that was great. That was great drive because I kept wanting to play and to get better at it and to learn more about those in-depth strategies.
I used to play a lot of Magic the Gathering, and the guy that I say he made me good, there's a store owner in Little Washington here in Pennsylvania. He was much better than I was, and I would play him all the time. And his thing was, you're only as good as the people that you play against. And that has resonated forever in my careers, in life. You're only as good as your competition, is the people that you're able to consistently play against and beat and learn from, for that matter. So you're playing a lot of chess. I assume at some point this segued into what we would consider modern board gaming. Most folks have that story of, oh, then we discovered Catan or Carcassonne came along. What are some of the games today that you like to play?
There was definitely that transitional period, and it really didn't happen with me until college. I went through phases before that with, you know, little spotted like games here and there. But of course, you know, growing up and moving around a lot, there was a bunch of different things going on. But I was never like super attached to board games, like through an extended period of time. But then when I got to college and started having some downtime, and of course, you know, a lot of book learning at that time frame. And so it was really stoked on experimenting with and exploring ideas and learning new stuff. And so then I started to dive into some of the more involved games. I really started to get involved with cards a lot. Cards are just such a deck of cards, I think, is one of the most beautiful things. There's just so many possibilities and so many ways to manipulate that system. And so I got real big into playing all sorts of card games with friends in college. We even had, I remember this one group of friends that we had this house, and we would play this variation of Gin Rummy. And, you know, people would come in and out of the house in between classes, and friends would come in and out throughout the day. And in the little family sitting room, we'd have this board, and it would be sort of the board of house melds. And it was melds that people made up, essentially, that would zero out points for Gin Rummy. If you won a hand, you got to pick one of the melds, and that would count for the next hand. It'd be stuff like Ménage à Trois was like a king and two queens, or like, you know, some random things like that, different combinations of the cards to make zeroed out melds. And that was sort of my first sort of like taste of, you know, creating my own mechanisms for games, sort of creating my own like ways to change and manipulate games. After that, you know, there was a handful of fun little stuff that, you know, made this game simply called The Game, just using postcards with some friends, a few beverages on a rainy day, and just, you know, wrote down directions and then points, you know, tied to them. He just drew through the deck. And then more and more things sort of happened after that with a couple couple of other more involved designs. I remember building my own Munchkin deck. It was Quentin Tarantino themed, so it was a lot of fun, and I had a great time. It played really well. I still have it sitting around. I dug it out the other day because I'd been kind of thinking about it. And then I made a game that was built around Pabst Blue Ribbon bottle caps. I'm not going to go into details on it, but it was like it was a beautiful idea. It played like Scrabble and Upwords all together, and you like use the caps to create card melds and create point systems. And I thought it was a great promotional, like cross marketing effort for Pabst Blue Ribbon. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, like after months of trying to like communicate with them to try to work on trying to get something going with the IP or whatever, it just did not work out. So unfortunately, I had to kind of like ditch that idea, even though it was beautiful.
You know, it sounds like your background with gaming is actually a different arc than what I was expecting. I talked to a lot of designers and they typically say, oh, I got into this game and that game. And we used to play miniatures games every Saturday in college. And eventually that segued into, but for you, you said manipulating the card deck. It sounds like your enjoyment with games has been coming up with your own ideas, using your own creativity. At some point along the line here, Lonely Undead came to the surface. Was this something that you had been working on for some time and you finally pieced it together and put the theme on? Were you watching a TV show about zombies and said, wait a minute, what's the aha moment behind the creation of Lonely Undead?
I had some of this idea sort of on the back burner. Of course, like as I mentioned to you before we got started, I've moved around a lot over the last 7 years and I find myself like, you know, on the road a lot and being very mobile and being on the road and being very occupied with that sort of workflow and some of that travel doesn't really lend itself very well to, I think, what happens when you're like more have some more permanence and being stationary is you can kind of focus on certain creative outlets rather than, you know, whatever's occupying your time.
You can get in the zone. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Throughout that work over the last 6 or 7 years, I mean, I dabbled and always played games, always carried games with me when I was traveling and would get people introduced to them and like, you know, would create my own little fun variations of each game. Then basically the idea started to formulate when I started to sort of get into some more like dungeon crawler sort of games and really started to enjoy that and some deck building stuff. And I started to sort of compile in the back of my mind and started to make some little notes from time to time about these ideas for a game. And, you know, they just kind of sat on the back burner for a while. But then at the beginning of 2020, I was traveling. I usually work up in Alaska in the summertime, but I was down visiting family in Arkansas where I am now. That's when everything was going crazy with the pandemic and all the uncertainty was happening. And so I ended up being laid off from work and found myself sort of plopped down back in Arkansas around family and friends and had all this time on my hands. And there was all this uncertainty that was happening in the world. And I needed to focus on creative outlets to sort of keep myself occupied, keep myself in a healthy mental state. Because, of course, I was alone and a lot of weird things were happening. So I was trying to keep from slipping into a little depressive state. I love to focus on those creative outlets. So I was like doing a lot of art, doing a lot of music and playing and messing with games a lot. So I was able to focus a lot on these ideas and sort of work a little bit with them with all this time I had. And eventually I made a physical prototype and gave it a shot. And the first time I played it, it played decently and it was a decent time. And I was like, wow, there might be something here. Then I kept playing with more people and it got to the point where people were like, you know, you should try to do something with this. And I was like, you know, right now is a good time to sort of explore that idea. I have all this time on my hands and not doing anything else. And you know, why not explore it? Then, of course, I had a good buddy and that I played a lot with him, and he was very encouraging. He believed that I could, of course, with when you make a game, there's two routes to go. You can sort of self-publish or you can pitch to a publisher. Of course, there's pros and cons of each, you know, and mm-hmm. one is basically building a business and requires a lot more work. And that's the one I did not want to do to start off with. But I had a lot of encouragement, and anytime I said like I can't do that or I don't have the time for that, my buddies and family were like, "No, you can do it. We believe in you." And I was like, "Okay." And so after a couple of weeks of research into seeing exactly what it might take to fully develop and to self-publish a game, I decided, "Why not? I don't know what my immediate future looks like. I have all this time and space right now. Why don't I jump in and give Lonely Undead or at the time it wasn't Lonely Undead, give this game an honest go, like give it a shot, you know, maybe form this LLC, give it a go and just try to do it. And when I grab a hold of things and creative outlets like that and little hobbies and passions, I just I go full 110%, just full dedication and give as much as I possibly can to whatever it is. And, you know, if it fails, then I'm completely content with that, because that just means that, you know, I tried it and I gave it a go. I gave it my best shot. And, you know, if nothing works out, that I could at least say that I did it, like at least say I went through the experience and like went through those motions and gave it my best shot.
You said it wasn't Lonely Undead at the time. This didn't start off as a zombie theme?
It kind of did. The theme was definitely really kind of on the fence. I had a couple different ideas for the theme, and sort of with the dungeon crawler, you know, mindset when starting and working with the design, it was torn between, you know, some sort of normal, like, you know, what you would think of like a dungeon crawler sort of, you know, fantasy realm, and then also zombies. And early in the development, when I was exploring the zombie theme, of course, I'm a fan of zombies. Absolutely. I love zombie media. And I think there were some movies out in the time that I was into, and that was having some influence as well. I had explored the themes and talked to them with a couple of people, and I actually had some kickback because they were like, oh, you know, zombie games, like there's a lot of zombie games out there. Like that's going to be hard to do. You know, there's all the zombie games are sort of the same. They're sort of the same recycled stereotypes and the same sort of ideas that come to mind when you think of a zombie game. And I actually had these ideas with using the zombie theme for the game that I wanted to sort of change, do things differently with the zombie theme. And that sort of solidified my mindset of having to stick with the zombie theme, because I wanted to take all these things with the zombie theme and completely flip them around. I wanted to take all these recycled stereotypes and what you thought of what a zombie game was and change all of those aspects and deliver something different to the zombie theme, sort of like, you know, breathe new life into the zombie theme, try different things and show that you can still be creative with what people might call a flooded market or an area that's been sort of worked a lot. And so that's why I had to stick with the zombie theme at that point. And I'm glad
there are zombie games of all kinds of varieties, no doubt. And this take is very fresh. It's a way to, as you said, it's a way to look at this genre and from a different angle and give it some unique flavor. And I think you succeeded in that regard.
A lot of people played the game now. It's been floating around for some time with different creative circles and different other content creators. That's definitely the thing that really sets it apart the most, I would say. There's a lot of things that set it apart, but definitely the unique take on the theme, the spin on the zombie tropes, flipping the perspective and working with it differently definitely sets it aside for sure.
Well, Shelby, we started to talk a little bit about the development process and how the theme came about. Let's talk a little bit about from the beginning. You know, you have this idea for a game and it's in your mind and you got to put it to paper. And I'm sure that there's been tons of plays. I saw on Board Game Geek, there's pictures up of, you know, people play testing the game and the modifications throughout. Tell us a little bit about the process that an aspiring designer might have to expect if they're going to give a game the treatment, if they're going to run it through the mill of taking it from the rough copy to a, we'll say, a polished, well-refined version of a game. Tell us what happened in those regards with Lonely Undead.
I think this is an interesting sort of topic to delve into, because I feel like every sort of designer in a lot of ways has, you know, different takes and different processes and different motions they go through. And so I think it'd be really interesting, actually, if I actually talked to other designers and found out more about their secret process, because I can imagine it being so differently. I've definitely talked to others where their process is just so much differently than what mine was. But it's whatever works for you, for sure. And with that being said, when I start working with ideas, I spend a lot of time thinking. I definitely enjoy just some peace and some solidarity and just kind of being in my own thoughts, and I can sort of work through things. And I definitely find myself, you know, laying in bed at night, just like running through ideas and running through sort of, you know, well, if how could this work? If this would work with this idea, and just sort of, it gets to the point after doing this so many times, then I start filling up notebooks. So I actually have these notebooks and just have pages and pages of graphs and diagrams and like text. And of course, nobody can read them but myself, which is fine.
Of course, but, chicken scratch, right?
Yes, absolutely. But that's all that matters, is that I can read them. And that's where it kind of starts, you know, from those ideas and lots of time thinking. And then it moves into pages and pages of scribbles. And then eventually those scribbles, I start to want to try to, you know, put them on individual components and start to like work with, you know, more of a physical prototype. That's sort of like the flow of my process. And then, of course, when you start working with a physical prototype and start actually playing, that's when That's when things get nitty and gritty. You can have all these beautiful ideas and they all make sense like in your head and on paper. But when you start applying them in real life situations, I can't tell you, I've actually feel very lucky with Lonely Undead because I have like tried, you know, some other games and stuff, or I've heard of other designers being like, oh, I had this great idea. I worked it out on paper for like, you know, 6 months, built a physical prototype, got it to the table. We did 2 turns and it's completely broken. Like there is no way to move forward past this one problem and it needs some serious reworking. And I'm very lucky that I didn't encounter any massive, like, you know, completely broken mechanisms when I first started doing those physical tests, but you learn more and more each test. And there's so many different variables with Lonely Undead. There's a lot of combinations. There's a lot of replayability with the systems in play. Of course, I've played a lot with myself and played a lot with other friends. And then I started getting it out in public and, you know, hundreds of hours of play tests later, I feel like I got to a point. I almost had to get to a point where, you know, new things were kind of coming up and I was getting feedback from each play test. And I was like, I can't just keep making changes. And I definitely remember when I was learning through some like reading stuff about the design process that you got to get to the point where, you know, your game's not going to get to the point where it's like the best it can be. It's not going to get to the point where it's like perfect. You know, it's got to get to the point where like, it's the best it can be like now, you know, this is a good place for it to be right now. Because if you just keep working, you'll just keep making changes and the game will just never really sort of solidify and never sort of like focus on one sort of like polished product. It'll just keep evolving.
It's like you can always do something for the sake of quote improvement. And you can do that perpetually. You can just continue to do that. It's sort of the too many cooks spoil the soup. You end up with that problem too, where I feel like if you have an idea, you have this concept for a game and people are trying it and they're enjoying it so much so that they're willing to give feedback and say, "Ooh, what if you did this? What if you did that?" Mm-hmm. That excitement, that comes from the fact that your game to begin with is solid. You know, if you're giving them tic-tac-toe and saying, "Okay, how would you revise it?" You might not even get a response. You'd be like, "Oh, yeah, it's not for me." You know what I mean? To brush it aside, but you are getting those responses. That means that the core game is solid. It doesn't need a whole lot. People are just coming up with what might be their preference. And you know what? If you try and please everybody, you end up not pleasing anyone.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is my first like major design as far as, you know, going to full development, as far as like seeing it out through every sort of aspect of the design to through development. And I've had to learn a lot as I've gone along. I've had to learn a lot with evaluating feedback, when, how to take things with a grain of salt, how to not try to please everybody, how to like also communicate when people give me feedback to make them feel like they're being validated, but at the same time, don't be like, no promises towards right, whatever that answer is. So it's been an interesting journey of like learning just, you know, how to communicate and take feedback and evaluate it properly. And at the beginning, of course, with feedback, I would take everything to heart, or I would have to think everything I got, I'd be like, okay, well, let me try that, or let me experiment with that, or let me make that change. And that just was a mess. And it wasn't really like cohesive to me doing what I actually wanted to do with the game. I was like, wait. And then I realized like, wait, you know, I started to sort of reflect back on my degrees in my college years and be like, wait a second, like a sample size of one, like I'm not supposed to take that to heart. You know, that's not good science.
If it continues to roll in from reviewer yes. after review and tester after tester, then you say, oh, okay, you know what, this there's a consensus here that maybe this needs to change, or maybe this can be dropped or added, et cetera.
Yeah.
Scott and I talked a bit about the gameplay of Lonely Undead, but I wanted to hear it from you. There are, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's 4 different modes of play in the game. You have this customizable board. Let's talk about the different ways that someone backing can expect to play the game. Before we get rolling, I'll say you mentioned that you played a whole lot of card games. And I think card games, I think, okay, you got to do some thinking. There's a little bit of bluffing, but things are kind of finite. Like I know what cards I have. I have some hidden information, but it's very calculative. Whereas this, you've heard the term Ameritrash, I'm sure. It has elements of randomness, which personally, and I said this in an earlier episode, I like elements of randomness in a game. If I can just math out everything in my head, well, it's not a game. It's a math problem. Sometimes I'm in the mood for that and I'll play a game that does that. But typically I like it whenever we have some randomness infused. So why don't we start with the competitive mode?
Absolutely. The base mode of the game is definitely the competitive mode. It sets itself up a lot in a way what you would classify as a race for the mode. So you are essentially racing towards an objective before everybody else. Each player will take their turns performing a number of actions, and they're basically, we hadn't really discussed necessarily. I'm sure some people watching might be like, well, what exactly is the story behind the game? So brief synopsis real quick. Lonely Undead, the players...
Let's take it to theme. Yeah, let's take it right to theme. Yeah.
So they know what we're talking about here. The players in Lonely Undead, they are embodying recently infected zombies. The event takes place in basically the beginning of an event, not necessarily in the middle of some sort of zombie apocalypse, but this fog rolls through this town. People start acting a little funny, and these certain individuals start to become, they become zombies, and they start to go around seeking solidarity. They're kind of lost and confused. You're playing through the zombie, through this perspective, and they're seeking out friendship. And the only way they know how to make friends, unfortunately for some people, is to bite and infect the locals.
Got to convert them.
Yes, you got to convert your friends. That's the only way they know how to make friends. And so in the game, you are moving around as a zombie through this town, crawling around these unsuspecting townsfolk. You're interacting with all sorts of elements within the town, and you are trying to go around and convert the locals to make them your friends. And so in the competitive mode, it's a race to the first individual that can, the first Z, they're called Zs in the game for shortening it up, and the first Z who can successfully make 7 friends is the main objective. There's a number of elements. You have your turn and you can take a number of actions. You know, you move around the board, you're gathering resources, which are from piles of cards. There's a pile of card that you essentially can draw resources from. And, you know, thematically, they're like in a backpack and you can throw them out and equip them. And they give you various skills and abilities to help you accomplish your goals. Maybe it'll make you faster. Maybe it'll make you stronger. And then in that competitive mode, something that's nice is there is a level of interaction with the other players as well. Some cards you can play on other players to manipulate the situation to make it harder for them or more difficult. Or say they have a really good die roll and you may want to, like, you know, use a certain card to mitigate that die roll instead of use it for your own mitigation later, because you want to try to slow them down because maybe they're making more friends than you. If they do a bad job at making a friend, they don't successfully infect them, that you can kind of swoop in and kind of take their scraps in a way. If they didn't do a good job, you can swoop in on their hard work and you can take the friend from them. There's different ways to sort of interact with the players. Sometimes when I watch people play co-op or the competitive mode, they'll like sort of go off on their own routes and just kind of like don't have a lot of interaction. But it kind of depends on how you want to play the game, what kind of style you have, and how often you're kind of working through those resources as well.
You know, one of our playthroughs, the guy that won, his thing was, I'm going to hang out near the other players because we would injure one of the living. And then you go to bite and you wouldn't get the bite. So you put the mark, so I can't bite. And what would he do? Run in, bite them. You do all the hard work. You set them up. Yeah. You get them injured. You get them feeble and ready for conversion. And he was taking the guys. It was like, oh, come on. Mm-hmm. But it was a successful strategy. Now, had our bites been successful after the attack, the first go round, and we'd converted them, he'd have been just following us around, watching us making friends. So it does go to show that there are a couple of different options for how you can pursue your game.
That strategy is sometimes effective. Sometimes it doesn't pan out. Like if it doesn't work like a couple of turns, you know, it could be very wasteful and not progressive at all for that player. So it could go both ways for sure.
I actually tried to emulate that strategy in the second playthrough, and it didn't work at all. In fact, I got hit by the car twice.
Oh,
I lost two limbs from the car. I don't think I had the dog chasing me, but it felt like the whole world was trying to get me. I love the car. There's a little meeple in the and I mentioned this in the 8-bit breakdown, but I absolutely love that there is a car piece moving. It plays almost like a non-player character in some of these sandboxy games, and I was getting a little sense of that with Lonely Undead. I would call it more of an action selection game. Like you said, you have a list of actions that you choose from and you get to perform 4 actions per turn. So it is kind of determining how to allocate those actions to make the most efficient turn that you can. However, there is kind of a sandbox feel to the game. Which building am I going to go to? Am I going to play a real aggressive take that game against the leader? Am I going to try and mill through that deck to find the cards with the car symbol and try and run people over, kill a survivor right before he gets to them? You do have some options beyond just the action selection. I thought that was a lot of fun. Now, one thing that we didn't do was explore the solo mode. I understand there's a co-op mode as well. Tell us a little bit about some of the other ways that players can play the game.
Absolutely. When I started to really dive into the design of this game, I made a list of some things that I really wanted to make sure were a part of the game and part of the design process. you know, with a lot of games these days, they sort of like focus on one mode and then they get to Kickstarter and then there's so much draw and so much compulsion for like trying out and adding different modes. And so sometimes they'll tack on other modes into it. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't want to do that. And I had that mindset at the beginning that I wanted all of the options for the modes. I wanted to create like a game that gave just massive amounts of replayability, and any sort of person with a certain type of game style and sort of combination of events, they were able to pull out Lonely Undead and apply it to that situation. I, you know, I told you I moved around a lot and I carry a lot of games with me. I don't carry them in boxes because they just take up so much space. I actually break them all down and put them in Ziploc bags and carry them around mm-hmm. in a backpack. And so I have a game bag that holds like, it's got like 20 something titles in it. It's really heavy, but really deceiving. And I carry it around when I go and hang out with people for games, because games are applicable to sort of any situation. I can kind of feel it out and be like, oh, this is more of a party vibe. You know, I know what games will work well. Or I can tell that these people are like ready to sit down and kind of think a little bit. I have games for that. And I think that really solidified that mindset when I was designing Lonely Undead to be able to apply the game to any sort of situation for player type. And so I designed from the beginning with solo and cooperative modes as part of the design process. So the base game, the competitive mode, it has the Z phase where the players take their turns. And then it has an AI phase where the town basically has its turn. Mm-hmm. And so there is this NPC, as you said, these non-playable character elements happening. There's dynamic AI elements that are interacting with you throughout the town phase. And that happens in the competitive game. And it translates very well over into the cooperative game, because now instead of working against the other Z players, you are working together. The town still has its phase as it was, as it does in the normal game. And it's just kind of working against you in a lot of ways more aggressively. So in the, like I said, the race for the competitive mode, first person to 7 friends wins the game. But in the cooperative mode, you're basically trying to convert the whole town. So you're essentially trying to make 15 friends, convert the whole whole town and your own little zombie community. All the while, the town is working against you. And it has one way to win, where you try to convert the whole town. And it has 4 ways to lose, just like sort of a pandemic style, multiple ways to lose, one way to win sort of setup, which makes it, you know, some of those like lose conditions are like, you know, time qualifiers to help keep things in check. They're sort of like, there's escalative meters that are part of the process as well. If you're doing really bad at making friends, then you are actually, people are dying in the streets and the town gets more notice of that. And they start ramping up their reactions to you. More bad things start to happen to you if you keep being bad at making friends, which I think is an interesting element as well, is that the objective, of course, you don't want people to die. Like, you're trying to convert them. You're trying to make them into zombies. And actually, people dying is a really bad thing in the game.
How about the solo mode?
Yeah, with the solo mode, it plays almost exactly the same in a lot of ways. It translates directly over. But instead of having help, instead of like racing, you are in a lot of ways still racing, but you basically are still just fighting the town itself. The main difference is, there's the town phase in which you will draw a reaction card, and it has a number of different things that could come out. They're mostly negative effects. They are reactions to your mayhem and your shenanigans in the town. The town sort of acting back during the nighttime phase, during the town phase. As a solo mode, you will draw 2 of those instead of 1. You'll do 1 and then the other. So it's basically twice the amount of consequences that you might normally receive. And so it sort of puts this like sort of vice and this pressure on you. And then, you know, along with the co-op mode, you have all those ways that you could still lose. You have limbs. There are little cute little limbs that basically represent your ability to play, that represent your life because you're already dead. And there are a number of things that can cause you to lose these limbs, such as being attacked by a rabid dog that is one of those dynamic, you know, non-playable characters that could be chasing after you. Or maybe you're in the road and a random driver drives through town and ends up bowling you over and takes one of your limbs, as you recall, maybe it happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know,
or you
when you say limbs. Cute little limbs, if I can interrupt you for a second, the limbs, your health is tracked by 4 limbs and they go on the bottom of your player board, and uh-huh. they're literally limbs. They're like cardboard punch out limbs. So you got a hand, one of the foots has a shoe on it. One's giving a thumbs up. It's like, oh, this is very clever. And you could have just had a bead over the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. The thematic element that you pulled just from having the life tracker being limbs, I thought that was really clever.
There's all sorts of like little tiny thematic nuances. Another thing, like we're going fully blown and really diving into every element with the design and the art and everything with this game. I've realized like what sort of games I truly like to create. And I'm very big on like, you know, some lore and some thematic elements and really making sure that every part of the game pulls a little bit of that theme out of it. And I definitely feel like Lonely Undead has the seepage constantly throughout play that you have all these thematic elements pulling out of it. Your interactions with the town and cars driving through and dogs moving around, they all sort of really set up this scene of what exactly is actually happening, like thematically in the real life event, you know, and you may be interacting with a certain living person, you know, and they have their own set of stats that you're combating against. They have little locational bonuses.
The stats can be modified based on where you found them. I thought that was boom. Brilliant. And you don't necessarily know what you're going to see whenever you flip over one of those living tokens. Like, is this going to be the priest in the church? Is this going to be, you know, the dad in the home or the officer? And Scott and I often say that sometimes a game has mechanics and things that you're actually doing that draw out the theme, not just the artwork, not just like the game tells you a story. No, sometimes what you're actually doing in the game feels thematic. And this had that with a little bit of a playful attitude, I noticed.
Humor and the sort of tongue-in-cheek and a playful attitude is also very important to what I wanted to do with Lonely Undead. It also plays into very well with my natural style of writing and who I am as a person. I love to laugh. I think jokes, you know, I love to incorporate funny elements and jokes into things that I do. And so it was really easy for me to really grab a hold of that and use that. Like I had said a little bit earlier about changing things with the theme, you know, normally a lot of time with these zombie games, you have this really dark theme. You have these like these overtones of mystery and violence. And I didn't, of course, you know, as I said, I didn't want to do a lot of those old things. So instead of focusing on a dark or violent theme, I really wanted to focus on a lighthearted, sort of humorous, tongue-in-cheek, the sort of really playful perspective of playing through the zombie and how it could kind of be kind of funny and lighthearted and maybe, you know, good for some families, and didn't want to like show a lot of like gore or blood. I wanted to really not focus on any of those violent aspects.
Axe in her head. Come on.
Yes. Yes. No, I will admit that is definitely like, I was on the fence for pulling the axe out of Brittany's head.
It's
for a
cartoony.
A while.
I liked it. Well, it's not gross. It's not like, ooh, this person's been bludgeoned and, you know, no part of the game did I find was like offensive or gory or gruesome or bloody for the sake of being bloody. It pulls you into the theme, but it does so in, like you said, tongue in cheek, kind of like a little sense of humor behind what it's doing. The theme of the game alone, you're looking for friends. You're not a zombie trying to convert people and you know, have zombies take over. No, you're looking for friends. I thought that just brilliant.
Yeah, it's definitely a really fun aspect. I love that. I think people grab a hold of that more than anything when they're talking about the game or they do a little intro on what Lonely Undead is. And I love it because everyone gets a little tickle out of it. You know, they're like, all right, so you're a zombie and your goal is to make friends. And it's just like, everyone's like, what? But it's just such a creative, like fun, like sort of thing to really to sort of grab a hold of. And it definitely pulls through well for Lonely Undead.
All right, so we have a live Kickstarter going on right now. Listeners, if you have the chance to go over there, you'll be able to see all of the artwork, you'll be able to see the limbs that I was talking about, the pledge tiers, et cetera. And we'll go over that a little bit right now. Before we do, though, you had mentioned, and I noticed on Board Game Geek, you're credited as the artist. Did you also do the graphic design for the Kickstarter?
Yes. Wow. I have been a really one-man show on this journey. It's kind of true to my nature. I'm a big fan of, even if I don't know how to do things and I see things as a massive hurdle, I get kind of excited about like, all right, like I have this resource, which is the internet, and you can learn how to do everything from it. And also being, you know, a one-man show and having a really tight budget for my first-time creator, being a startup, an indie startup, I didn't have a massive budget. And I love to do things myself anyway. So I did all the graphic design on the Kickstarter page, all the graphic design for the game itself. I did all the art for all the design and art for the game. I will say the on the game board itself, there is the little structures, the little like areas that you can play through, the buildings and locations. That was outsourced to another artist. I was like really busy during that time phase, and I was trying to get some of that stuff done, and found a nice gentleman by the name of Joe Mason, really nice guy, lives up north in Canada, and I worked with him, and he did the buildings, the locations himself. But everything else for the game, I did for the art.
So Shelby, I'm hearing what you have to say. Maybe I'm listening to the show, and I'm like, you know what? I might want to give this a shot. Tell us a little bit about your Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter is really, really simple and straightforward. I was really torn at one point during the design process. This will lead into the Kickstarter tiers, but it's kind of like a backstory into why. As I had said, I'd wanted all these different elements and all these different game modes available right from the beginning. And a lot of people with Kickstarters, they see that when they're developing, they see different modes start to come out. They actually see it as an opportunity to market a whole nother game. And a lot of times you'll have your base game and then you'll have your deluxe game that has all these additional sort of things added to it. Mm-hmm. And I really honestly didn't like that idea, which may have, you know, I think some people kind of turned some people off. Maybe it hurt me in some aspects, but I only see it as a positive because I wanted to basically give as much to the people as possible, especially as my first game. And I didn't see the idea and the really appeal of trying to make multiple games and then different versions. I just wanted the like base version to be the deluxe version. I wanted it to be everything out front and be available for everybody. So of course there is the base pledge, which is just the game itself. And of course includes any unlocked stretch goals. Beyond that, like I said, really simple. There's, you know, a discounted pledge for, you know, three copies, takes $5 off each copy. There's, of course, a retailer pledge. And then there's a couple of really fun special pledges that have to do with custom artwork.
I love the idea of custom artwork. Tell us a little bit about it.
We had mentioned the dogs earlier. The dogs are a really fun dynamic element that chase after the zombies and try to tear away their limbs. And I saw that as a really cool opportunity to offer that up to the people to give them this chance to have their dogs in the game. So what I did for a special pledge tier that's called the Fur Baby Pledge, where essentially you could have your dog be in this edition, be in this printing of the game. I work with images of your dog. I'm going to illustrate it in my style. It'll be put on one of those dog cards. Little face will go on the little token, and your dog will be in the game. Got stoked on that idea. I tested it out, like kind of played with how it would work logistically, and I think it's a blast. I have four of those spots locked in. Of course, there's going to be 12 total dogs in the game, so four of those spots are locked in. There's still some room there for other people to get involved. And of course, if they don't get filled, then I have backup dogs that are sort of generic that I could pull out as well. So that's a really fun custom art one. And then there's one more stage after that, definitely a higher tier, where there is the living people that you interact with in the game. These are characters with individual stats that you're trying to convert to make your friends. And I have four spots that I'm offering up for you or your best friend or whoever to actually be one of those living characters in the game.
There you go. A chance to be in a board game. The base pledge, I understand, is $55. You get an awful lot of game for $55.
You know, I was really torn on the price point because with Kickstarter, it's such a mysterious sort of confusing realm because you have to play in all these other factors. And sometimes just seeing the price point really turn people off even before they know maybe what sort of value or what they're really getting with the game. You know, some people I played the game with and, you know, after going through all the modes, how much replayability there is, you know, the custom side, the double-sided board, which we haven't even talked about, the build your own town, like, you know.
Oh, we hit that in our 8-bit breakdown. I thought that was fantastic. Oh,
fantastic, yeah. There's just loads of value sort of packed into it. So sometimes at first glance, if you don't know all those elements are there, certain price points can kind of turn people off. I played it with people, expressed all that, all the different ways to play, all the value, and they're like, you can make this a $75 game, and some people would have no problem with it. And I was like, you don't know how Kickstarter works. You know, that's I think that would turn a lot of people off. And then other people are like, your price point's kind of high. I think you would have more pledges and more people sort of hopping on board if it was lower and you could sort of like build something, you know, other price in elsewhere. And I understood where they were kind of coming from, but it didn't really make sense to me and didn't really work out in my logistics when I tried to think about putting it lower. So I kind of just tried to meet in the middle ground. I tried to take the actual like quantity of the physical components with all the manufacturing costs, all those things sort of into play, and then added in that extra value that you get with all those different game modes and all those levels of replayability. I wanted to take that into account with the price point. And so I kind of settled on 55 as a nice little happy medium between all those things.
Well, at the time that this episode goes live, we're going to have about a week and a half left that listeners can go back the game. You're on your way. You got to be excited. You got to be having the jitters, man. This has to be a real roller coaster for you right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of excitement. There is definitely a roller coaster of emotions. There's a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of stresses involved. There's some sleeplessness. There is, you know, all these thoughts and these worries. And it's definitely a taxing ordeal for sure. We're off to a decent start. We're not even halfway yet to funding, but there's still a lot of time left. It's live now, and we are on our way.
So I'm sure some people listening are getting a little interested, getting a little amped up about Lonely Undead. Say, I want to find out some more. Where do I go?
Yeah, the Kickstarter is live. That is definitely the easiest place to sort of find it.
Oh, now that's the low-hanging fruit.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very active on all the other sort of social channels. I wouldn't say all of them, but of course you can find out there's the website, which has a lot of information there, not only just about Lonely Undead, but also the organization Dead Lemon Games, in which I put the game under. We're active on Facebook. So there's a Facebook group for the game. Dead Lemon Games has a page there. Active on the Instagram as well. You can find Dead Lemon Games on Instagram. Of course, a handful of videos that have already been made by other content creators, and you can find those all on YouTube that are posted up there. Active
don't
want on BGG.
People going to other content creators. They're on Level Up Board Game.
Oh, sorry. Let's restart.
There are some fantastic videos up for this game. Whenever I was trying to learn it, there was only one up, but they had been trickling in from there. And I did get the chance since then to watch a few. I mean, you can get a full feel of the components that we're talking about, how fantastic they are, the limbs. That's your chance to go if you're interested in seeing this. Aside from the Kickstarter, you have a lot of the videos listed on the Kickstarter too.
I believe that the majority of other content that has been created is listed on the Kickstarter. There's, if not, you know, full embedded videos, links to that content. So lots of content out there, some really fun stuff. There's been some fun work with the game, a couple of playthroughs, some overviews, and very, very lucky and fortunate to have so many people being involved and, you know, being stoked about working with the game. So very lucky there.
Well, rightfully so. I think you've got a hit, and I do hope that this funds. I know you're a busy guy, so I suppose we're coming to the end of our time today, but I'm not going to let you go just yet. You remember whenever I said, oh, there won't be anything unexpected? I lied. At the Level Up Board Game Podcast, we like to give our designers a chance to level up. So here's what we're going to do, Andrew. What we like to do is give you the opportunity to level up by asking you 8 questions. Now, I just want you to say what comes to your mind first whenever I ask you this question. We're going to get the timer started. Scott, you ready?
Go.
Can you run a 5K?
Yes.
Who's your favorite Lonely Undead character?
Billy.
Cake or pie?
Cake.
The worst popular band ever is?
Nickelback.
Name a lunch meat no one should ever buy.
Liverwurst.
What is the last book you read?
The Wolves of Thakala.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Power Rangers?
Turtles.
If you were a zombie, who's the first person you would bite?
Oh, man. Probably Bezos or or Elon Musk.
And stop.
Hey! I think that is qualifying for a level up. Shelby, well done. Well, Shelby, thanks for playing our little game with us. Thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be keeping my eyes on this Kickstarter. If everything works out, I'll be a backer here by the end of the day today. Is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners before we get to signing off?
Absolutely. I'm a huge proponent of what games can do for people and individuals. One of my key values with Dead Lemon Games and what I'm trying to do with Lonely Undead is just sort of open up unique experiences that help people in a number of ways. You know, I'm a big proponent of the mental health benefits and developmental benefits of board games. So I just encourage everybody out there to, please check out Lonely Undead, but also play games. Get out there, interact with other people, break out of your social shell, kind of dive into those sort of cognitive experiences, and just enjoy interacting with other people. There's a lot of good that can come from playing games. So seek out your communities and seek out playing games.
Shelby, thank you so much for your time today. I look forward to hearing more after this thing funds and perhaps getting you on the show in the future.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you guys so much for having me on today. I had a really good time and I look forward to doing it again.
Thank you so much for joining this adventure of the Level Up Board Game Podcast. We encourage all adventurers to check out our website at levelupgamepodcast.com. There you can submit your thoughts and audio to be used in a future episode. Please consider rating us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and join the Board Game Geek Guild, Guild 3722. Music for the podcast provided by Adam Haynes. Learn more at adamhaynesmusic.com. And remember, you can spend another night on the sofa,
where you can get some friends together, get some adventures on the table, and level up.